Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
The Athletic.
Hello, I'm Mark Chapman. Welcome to the Business of Sport podcast on The Athletic. As usual, Matt Slater alongside us, football news reporter at The Athletic. Coming up today, with news of clubs of all shapes and sizes across Europe being sold, or nearly sold, or attracting new owners, we'll look at how a football club is valued, how deals are negotiated between the buyer and the seller, with our guest, Dr. Tom Markham. This is the Business of Sport from The Athletic. Before we bring Tom in, Matt, obviously takeovers, nearly takeovers, failed takeovers, administrations keep you very busy. Do you think it's happening more often, or is there just more interest in buying clubs? I mean, there's a whole load going on at the moment.
Well, today would suggest, yeah, it's happening. It's happening quite a lot. We're right in the middle of account season, which I know we've talked about is one of my favourite seasons of the year. And they are trickling in. I think we're up to about 15 out of the 20 Premier League clubs have filed accounts now. Picture we're getting is COVID really hurt different clubs in different ways, and it's really hard to do year-on-year comparisons because some of them have chosen to extend their year ends. There's a story coming, all will be explained. Another big one I worked on was the Barnsley multi-club model, which involves clubs in Belgium and Switzerland and Denmark and France, and just, you know, a fascinating way of approaching, if you like, the conundrum that is football these days. And they're actually doing pretty well on and off the field. Yeah, takeovers. So Wigan's just gone through, which is one of the reasons we're talking to Dr. Tom Markham. There's a couple that are coming today, today being Wednesday, which will be revealed in our little chat with Tom, kind of live. And yeah, there's a load more out there, loads of conversations with clubs. Premier League deals are obviously harder to get over the line because they are bigger sums, more complicated debt structure. But I think there's quite a lot going on.
Okay, well, let's bring Dr. Tom in. Dr. Tom Markham, a specialist in football finance and strategy and also head of strategic business development of Sports Interactive, makers of the legendary Football Manager series. Before we go into some of the stories that Matt mentioned there, maybe particularly Ipswich, but first of all, your background, where you've come from to be in this position.
Sure, yeah. Well, my background, I actually worked as a foreign exchange trader in the city for 3 years. I'd qualified as an accountant before that, didn't really enjoy any of that, decided to go back to university, did an MBA in football industries in the University of Liverpool, had a couple of job propositions in the industry, but ended up doing a PhD that specialized in football finance, worked with lots of on different projects for UEFA, national associations, etc. And then I went in as head of football clients at PwC.
I mean, you have been involved in recent attempts from groups, I don't know what you would, consortia, to buy football clubs.
Sure, yeah. Well, the most recent one actually was the Wigan deal, where I advised Mr. Al-Jazmi, the new owner, and I've actually, I was asked to become a non-exec at the club as well. So I worked on that deal, and that was an interesting one from administration. Previously, I worked with a German group from Hamburg who bought into Dunfermline, which happened in the last 12 months as well. But before that, two Chinese buyers, Yunyi at West Brom and Lander Sports at Southampton.
Why does somebody want to invest in Dunfermline, or why does somebody want to buy Wigan or any of them, actually? You know, we've done a lot of discussions on this pod, you know, for the whole variety of people about why you might want to buy a football club. And maybe there is this feeling trend to put various clubs in different markets together under a global brand. What are the benefits to investing in Dunfermline, for example?
I think that's a really good question, Mark. And actually, the German group were extremely diligent and professional that we worked with on that deal. And I think they looked at clubs in 9 different countries over an 18-month period. So they did things properly. But ultimately, why they decided on Dunfermline was that they felt that they could get the they could develop players and sell them into the English market. So one of the guys who's involved in that consortium is a cult hero at São Paulo, and he actually has he scored it in the only time they've ever beaten Bayern Munich. His name's Thomas Megel, but he's had every job at the club, from sort of starting on the analysis side to director of football to head coach. So they really have a big advantage on a lot of teams in Scotland. But ultimately, you've got the development of players route. But in Scotland as well, the fact that there's so little teams in the top tier, and I know Dunfermline aren't there yet, but they felt that's why there was value in it. But ultimately, if you're almost not getting relegated in Scotland, you're going to be qualifying for European competition with the new UEFA conference coming in.
Do they all have a common theme of we want to make money? And do you then have to say, in all of these, well, don't buy a football club then? Because that's the other message that comes across from a lot of people.
It's not the best industry to be making money, I'd say. If you know what you're doing, the scope to make money, and there's lots of examples of that. But most people would lose money in the industry. And people do it for lots of different reasons. So we have seen a lot more business people, particularly from the US, coming into this market. But the reason why they're coming into the UK and Europe in general is because the US sports market is so expensive. And they feel that it's undervalued and that there are more opportunities here. But ultimately, we're going to have to look at a model change and more financial control for clubs to be able to make money the way that sports in America do.
So when you talk about a model change, what do you mean by that?
I can't see it happen personally, but you would need more financial control. I think the whole idea of salary caps is pretty much illegal, but just finding the right balance to manage clubs' finances and for them not to be consistently spending outside of their means.
Why, in your opinion, are salary caps basically illegal?
It restricts a worker's ability to get paid what they deserve to get paid. And it wouldn't happen in any other industry. So, and I know FIFA are going down this route with agents as well. And I know we're going off on a slight tangent here, but it is an important one because clubs, that's where most of their money goes. So consistently you're seeing a well-run club might spend 40, 50% of their earnings on wages. Whereas you've got examples in the championship where people are going for broke, where it could be up to, 150, 200%.
Tom, I just wanted to jump in there because it's so interesting that the work you've been doing in the background. I've been dying to get you on the pod for ages. This work you've been doing in Scotland, it's really interesting because we've had a few multi-club owners, we've had a few people that kind of are sniffing around clubs in lots of different markets. And look, Scotland has interested them for the reasons you've outlined. But there's apparently a bit of a black mark against Scotland in that it doesn't like dual ownership. It doesn't. Its regulations are quite hard if you're trying to put together a multi-club model. Is that something you've come across?
Yeah, I think that is true. And there's certain markets that don't mind, Matt, that you've got clubs that don't mind being part of a bigger picture and part of a, let's just say, a holistic cycle for the development of players and everything else. But Scottish football is very well attended per capita. People are, it's quite tribal. People like their local clubs. So I think it's, aside from the regulatory stuff, it's a difficult market to go in and do that. But I think it is a very interesting market for a variety of reasons, and predominantly for the development of British players, because the value of British players is going to go sky high. Because of Brexit and the GBE regulations for signing overseas players. So you've got a situation where their model was probably slightly different initially. They would have been looking at a more of a Huddersfield or a Norwich style model where they take in some German players, because a lot of the German sort of reserve and under 23 leagues have been disbanded. So that you've got this gulf where players from the biggest teams are just been released and they might go to Bundesliga 2. They might end up in the regional third tier, but there's lots of very good players who are extremely professional, who physically would fit into the British game. And I think that was their initial model, and they've had to tweak it.
We've also got a very, very unsubtle habit of crowbarring references into previous podcasts. And the other thing that often comes to mind, or certainly crops up in conversations around Scottish football, even the Irish leagues, is cross-border leagues. Are you hearing punters, investors starting to make, dare I say, punts on what may happen with a league becoming more attractive, more money coming into a league because it's merging?
100%. And it was no secret over what happened from a Belgium and Netherlands perspective. I think that was always on the cards. And there was previously, actually, strangely enough, a failed version with the Women's League, where it just became dominated by the Dutch clubs. But I think if you look at the power base at UEFA, you have, you know, someone at the top of the pyramid who's from Slovenia. You've got another person who's from Serbia. You've got another person who's from Greece. They're all markets where there's really big clubs in small leagues. And I think you're going to see a situation across Europe where there might be another layer that comes into the pyramid that will be regional divisions for some of these, but there'll be decent solidarity that goes back into the system, and this will all be done on UEFA's watch. It won't be your stereotypical breakaway league where the big boys take everything and there's nothing left for anyone else. And I know that UEFA are looking at those type of proposals, and that's obvious from what happened in the Netherlands and Belgium, as we said.
Does that then increase the value of all football clubs or of only some?
I think it would definitely increase the value of the clubs that are in those markets, and it potentially increases the value of the ones where that would be part of those type of leagues if they do get off the ground. There's a lot of politics to contend with here, and there's a lot of jostling for position, but I think it's ultimately about creating value for some of the leagues where I think it's good from a supporter perspective as well. I remember Jeremy P said to me when we were working on the West Brom deal that all of the supporters preferred when they were in the Championship and winning than barely hanging on in the Premier League, that it was a better supporter experience. So if you take all of the bigger teams out of a smaller league, it gives everyone else a chance to have some glory. They can qualify for European competition and everything else, but that would be a playoff style model. It'd almost be like what happens in the Pro 14 rugby, where only a certain amount of teams would be allowed to qualify for say European competition, and there'd be a playoff annually from the champions of that division against the lowest placed team. So that'd be the sort of mechanism you'd be looking at.
It's interesting that Jeremy P said that, because I often have this argument with people within football who don't see things from a fan's perspective. When you say, you know, there comes a point where you get fed up as a fan of settling for 15th every single year in the Premier League, and you kind of want a bit of excitement. And sometimes maybe that is dropping down a division and not knowing what's going to happen. And yet, from your point of view and from the money men's point of view, they'd always take 15th or 16th in the Premier League every time, wouldn't they, rather than the excitement of the Championship. That's the problem.
I think this has always been an issue, Mark, and you see it in the cup competitions. Every so often, some of the smaller teams will have a good run. A lot of the clubs that are potentially looking like they could be in a relegation dogfight just dive out of the cup straight away, because they don't want to play the games. And from a supporter's perspective, that's terrible. You'd rather have some silverware than just stay there because you're getting 100 million a year from broadcast revenue.
You've developed a tool, haven't you, to measure the value of football clubs. I just wonder, first of all, how did you devise that? How much work had to go into it? And then I'm going to pick a random club and you can tell me what we'd put in place to value of that club.
The model that I developed, it's quite a simple model, but it's very, you know, it allows comparison and quick calculation. But it has been used in quite a few sort of transactions and people... it's a difficult thing to do to value a football club. So it's very much an indication, but it's focused on the key variables here. So it's turnover, it's profitability, it's cost management, which is usually, as we said, around wages to turnover, it's use of capacity of the stadium. So that's how everything works. So it doesn't tend to change. And obviously net assets as well, which will include, you know, the main assets. You look at a football club, you've got tangible fixed assets of a stadium, a training ground. You might have some other property, and then intangible fixed assets of player contracts, having the economic right to use those players for the duration of those contracts. So that's what it's made up of.
Well, Tom, we don't need to ask you a hypothetical question about a club and a club valuation, because you've just bought one, or you've been involved in buying one. But I know you probably can't tell us exactly how much you've paid for Wigan, or the group's paid for Wigan. I understand it to be around 2.3 million. Now, of course, at one point they were asking for 4 million, but that's a movable feast. They couldn't shift it at 4. So, you know, just got to like selling a house. It's got to come down a tiny bit. And also they were selling assets, weren't they? And this has been a bone of considerable contention with Wigan fans. Now, I don't expect you to start having pops at the administrators, because they had a tough job to do. How hard was it to price Wigan? You know, a club who were, let's be honest, a year ago, a solid championship club with a good squad, lots of good young talent in their academy. Now, a lot of that's gone now. So what have you got left, and how do you price that?
It's a difficult one to price. So just going into that, at the start of this whole process, the administrators were looking for between 8 and 10 million for the club. And as you said, they needed to pay the bills. So they obviously had to cut back on everything. They sold a lot of the more sellable players. They're doing their job under the circumstances, Matt. And it is a very, very difficult job. But there is an appeal to buying a football club that's effectively been cleared out. It's almost a blank canvas, and you've got no debt. You don't have a lot to work with. It's a big rebuilding project. But the reason that Mr. Al-Jazmi and the chairman, Talal, his son-in-law, wanted to get involved in Wigan, it's an interesting one, actually, because if you look back to Wigan's recent success, the FA Cup in 2013, and you look at the makeup of the team, you obviously had Al-Habsi in goal. In around that era, you had Zaki, who had that phenomenal first half to that season. I was actually at Anfield when he scored that incredible goal, and a lot of people stood up on the cop, and you had Mido. So I think I remember spending some time in the Middle East around that time, and Wigan were getting so much coverage because you had Arabic-speaking players. They were, you know, it was almost games on loop, but interviews with the likes of Al-Habsi on loop. So I think they got a lot of coverage during that era in the Middle East. And I know from the conversations that I've had, particularly with Talal, that has influenced the decision, that there is a perception. And this is back to what you spoke about earlier on, Mark, the reasons why people buy football clubs. They are, Talal in particular, is really interested in football, and he's friends with the Agnelli family, for example. So there's other, aside from the fact that he's really interested in this project and wants to rebuild Wigan and bring it back to where it should be, there's other aspects to business and being able to take someone to, you know, watch your football team for a weekend, that style of things. And I think that's always been in football since the very start, that it's always been a wealthy person's, I wouldn't say plaything, because it's definitely not. It's more strategic than that now. But for someone to have that as part of their armory and everything else, I think it is a big deal.
Just Tom, just on going back to the nuts and bolts of what Talal has bought at Wigan. So obviously he's bought, as you say, some goodwill, a brand. He's bought a golden share in a good competition, good pedigree, People know Wigan. I mean, the other bid that got close, of course, was Spanish. And there's a famous Spanish link with Wigan. So it has an appeal beyond Lancashire. It did, and it still does, have a very productive pipeline of talent. It taps into that kind of Northwest thing. It picks up a lot of players that you perhaps don't quite make it at Man United and Man City. It's done well there in Liverpool. Training grounds, it's got a long lease. So just you know, how do you do that? I mean, how do you sort of say, okay, the academy's worth a million, the training ground, I like the training grounds. The lease is, it's got a good relationship with the council, so I'm going to put that value on that. I mean, how do you actually say to your client, you're overpaying, you're underpaying? You've got a steal here.
The administrators have certain costs, and you almost have to hit as close to their figures as you can. So it's not your stereotypical, let's just say, negotiation where you're advising on different valuations and, you know, you're almost getting down to a due diligence stage where you're looking at what the value of all the assets are, including the players. So this one, it was slightly different from that perspective. You did have to hit a certain figure. You've mentioned about Ipswich. I know you broke that story. But if you look at that value in comparison to Wigan's price, you know, there's a significant difference in there. And I know Wigan would be deemed to be, I wouldn't use the word distressed because it's not distressed. And I think in some ways it's a good thing to have, to be able to buy a club where there's, say, five players who are still under contract, because it allows you strategically more leeway in a market where you're looking at what happened in the Championship in recent days, where a lot of clubs are struggling financially. So if you have financial resources, you can go in and manage this in the right way. But I think it was very, very good value. No matter what happens, obviously the club, we've had some conversations and Liam Richardson is getting all the support that he needs to do everything he can to keep the club in League One. But, you know, you've got a model for every eventuality.
So there are a couple of things in this. I understand, you know, stadia and training ground and the actual physical assets and how you can value those and how you look at, you know, leases and so on and so forth. How do you work out a value for where the club are placed within the football pyramid? So, you know, if you're looking at buying Ipswich, then Ipswich, just looking at the table, are in a better position than Wigan. So how much? Yeah. So how much do you buy? How can you value where a side is in the football pyramid?
That's a really good question, and I've looked at this, particularly for clubs that have been close to Championship, let's say top of Championship or heading towards the Premier League. And there's two distinct different values. But the simplest way to look at this, Mark, from experience, and if you look at historical prices, it almost doubles the value depending on which division you're in. So if you look at something like a club like Cambridge United, for example, Cambridge United would have been available for, say, 5-6 million would have been the asking price there. If they go up, you're probably looking at double that, which is sort of in line with the size of the club, the level that Ipswich, the figure that Matt has quoted of 17.5 million. And the same again, if you go up to the Championship, you can probably double that again, because the smallest teams that have been sold in the Championship, you're still talking at a sort of 25 million up to probably, you can put a one in front of that for the biggest clubs that are in there. But it's a very, very simple rule of thumb, but you can definitely double the price, the asking price, depending on which division you're in.
Like so many things in football, I think the value of virtually everything is subjective, isn't it? I mean, how do you value, you know, you're putting this bid together to buy Wigan. How do you value the playing squad? Because a player that's worth $100,000 to Wigan might be worth $300,000 to a side in the Championship if they desperately want someone in that position. There's no set model, is there, within football to be able to value players?
No, people have tried it. You know, there's been various models that have been developed, but there's so many parameters and so many factors that are in there. There are some good companies, the likes of the 21st Club, that will do due diligence on players. I've heard of examples of people using independent agents, maybe three agents, and getting values of where they would think they are.
So would due diligence on a player be, I tell you what, Wigan have got this central midfielder, he's 22, he's got 2 years left on his contract. Let's phone five directors of football at Championship clubs to find out what they would offer for him and take the average. I mean, is it that? I mean, I apologise if that's a really simple, stupid question, but I'm just trying to get my head around it.
No, it wouldn't quite be at that level, because, again, if you were phoning a director of football, there could be a conflict and they might know that player is available, etc. So they would, and a lot of this is very secretive. And there are other factors here in terms of earnings, in terms of injury history, in terms of, you know, age. So definitely, there's some clubs that do this brilliantly and have almost squad legacy management, whereas other clubs just go along with it.
Squad legacy management?
Yeah. Well, they'll be looking at the age group and how often a player is playing and what they're earning, etc. I know a few people who've done that at director of football roles, and they've done it brilliantly.
Is football too secretive then? Why is it so secretive? Because it doesn't need to be this way, does it?
I think because you look at other industries where, you know, a lot of other industries, you're just trying to obliterate your competition and be the only show in town. Whereas from a football perspective, you need the competition to survive. So you have a situation where those secrets can be the difference, or perceived to be the difference, between success and failure. But I agree with you. I think more transparency is needed. I think it's getting a lot more systematic. It's getting a lot more professional on the data side. So I agree with you. I think, you know, you just need to manage the resources that you have in the best manner that you can.
You've done some deals for Chinese buyers. And again, this is a big theme that we've been talking about for some time. You know, Chinese money came in on the big soccer boom off the back of their kind of government saying, yeah, we're going to win the World Cup. We're going to do it in a hurry. Go out and invest in football, and, you know, the knowledge will flow back. Hasn't quite worked out. Change of policy back home, and we are seeing the flight of Chinese money back to China. You mentioned a couple of deals you helped with. I know both those clubs are for sale. Are you facilitating the sale of West Brom and Southampton?
I think it's no secret that both of those are on the market, and conversations have been had. It's obviously difficult, particularly on the Southampton side, with the losses that have been posted. But it's fundamentally a really, really good club. So I think there's a lot of opportunity there, but you're spot on in terms of what's happened in China, and you only have to look at the situation at Inter and everything else. It's a little bit of a mess, but I think they just have pulled back, change of policy. But it was interesting at the time, because we've had these phases in football that at one stage, probably in the early to mid 2000s, anyone with a Russian accent would every door would open. We've seen it with the fake sheikhs along the way, you know, from a Middle Eastern perspective, and obviously China was the next wave. And I was very well connected in China and was able to tell who was, through contacts over there, who was real and who wasn't. And that was obviously a massive benefit at the time. But yeah, the policy has definitely changed. But I still think that they will get it right. You only have to look at what's happened with Qatar and their success in Asia. I know they've had a big budget, but they've a tiny population. And I think China would have a big budget and a big population. So I think they will get it right eventually.
Well, I mean, a couple of people I've been talking to the last few weeks have been saying, oh, yeah, I mean, the story clearly is that, you know, the return of Chinese money back to China and, you know, getting out of European football positions. They said the story you should probably be telling now is when they come back, because they'll be coming back they'll have learned something, hopefully, And, you know, that money is going to... China's not giving up on football. But just what I'm intrigued with, given how strategic you are and you come at it, you sort of try and talk about numbers and you explain things. What did those guys want? When you had conversations with them, what did they think they were buying? Because, of course, Wigan is another example of someone that was, you know, a club that was owned by Chinese buyers that clearly didn't quite understand what they were buying.
Yeah, I'm not sure about the Wigan situation. And I have spoken to Darren Royal and Darren in particular, and he wasn't aware of what happened at the time. Two different things with West Brom and Southampton. I think with Southampton, they wanted to roll out the academy and sell the academy as a model in China and almost monetize that. So that was obviously a big element. With West Brom, I think it was the smallest club that was consistently making money in the Premier League. So they felt that it was self-sufficient. But a lot of that was down to Jeremy Peace and how he ran that club with an iron fist, and without him there, that didn't necessarily happen. But they did bring him back for that reason, and he was a consultant. So, like we said at the start, people buy clubs for different reasons, and it has to fit into your overall rationale.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Tom, you're also you're also well known for your work with Football Manager, and it's often sort of come up just how realistic that game is, how well designed it is. And whilst the gamification of everything is one of the other big themes at the moment, and we're turning everything into a game, is buying football clubs, is that a game?
I personally, I'd like it, although it's one of those that when you're involved in something in real life, do you want to spend your spare time doing the exact same thing on a simulation? But some people do. But Football Manager obviously has stayed ahead of the curve. We're now up to 1,500 scouts globally that are providing all of the data. And like, to put that in perspective, you've spoken about some of the multi-club models. Some of the bigger clubs that are in that would have, say, 40 global scouts. So it's not even in the same stratosphere. So the guys are really, really good on that front, and always trying to replicate what's happening in reality.
Just going back to the buying and selling of clubs then, and we've talked about the ones that we've mentioned, some that have gone wrong, not necessarily that you've been involved in, but that have gone wrong. When you're involved in these deals, because you're obviously a sports fan and a football fan and love the game, how much do you investigate the people looking to buy when you are involved in a deal? Because, you know, fans are very sceptical about most owners when they come in, and quite often fans are proved to have been right to be sceptical about owners.
Yeah, I think that's a really good question, Mark. And it's something that personally I investigate a lot of time into that. And I've had lots of approaches where people might necessarily have the money, but they're quite unsavory characters and you don't want to be associated with them. And on that basis, just walked away. So that's happened quite a lot. And I try to be very, very upfront with people as well in terms of what they should be doing and what my advice is on that. And sometimes that's at the peril of talking them down from doing a deal. But I'm not around for a quick buck. I'm someone that you know, I know a lot of people in the industry, I'm trusted in the industry, and it's on that basis. And sometimes that's the way you need to, it needs to happen. But from an EFL perspective, I think the EFL were very diligent in terms of their checks and everything that they did. I got the impression that's ramped up after what happened to Bury and, you know, some of the other clubs that got into financial difficulty, that they really want good quality owners in, and they want owners that have the resources to be able to fund clubs going forward.
But it sounds in some ways, Tom, that you have your own individual fit and proper person's test that might actually be more morally apt than the ones that are put in place by the football authorities. I don't know, but it sounds like you have your own before getting involved with anyone.
Yeah, no, I definitely do, but I wouldn't necessarily agree with the latter part of your statement. But
there's more breaking news for you. So we are recording this podcast at 10 to 11. It's now 10 to 11 on a Wednesday morning. You've already revealed before I've had a chance to reveal it, Tom. Though it will come out later, so this is all a bit surreal. The Ipswich takeover is about to be announced. We'll play a little guessing game here. Another deal has just been done. I'll give you the division, the championship. A deal has been agreed between a long-standing owner, very similar to the owner of Ipswich in many ways, and he's finally managed to find a buyer for his club. One guess each.
Well, let Tom go and then I'll have a guess.
It's been a bit of a saga, this one.
Oh, God.
Are you going to say...
This is my guess. You couldn't be giving more clues away.
You go ahead, Mark.
I would guess all on your clues. And I haven't seen anything. Derby.
Correct.
Oh, there you go.
Well done, Mark.
I didn't have to go there, but it would have been in my three guesses. I don't know if I'd necessarily have gone with that in the first one.
I want to hear your other guesses. I want to hear your other guesses, Tom, because those will be the next stories.
Maybe that's for the next time on the podcast.
Derby, Tom, has been a very difficult club to sell. And obviously, this has only just happened, so you might have no idea. Why has it been a difficult club to sell?
I think predominantly because Mel Morris has invested a lot of money into the club. So to do a deal, he's clearly not going to get his money back on this. So it's what sort of haircut he takes along the way and how that deal is structured. So often they're the most difficult deals because Mel Morris is a big Derby fan as well. And he's emotionally attached to what's happened. And I'd say that there's elements. I remember having a conversation with Massimo Cellino, and he talked himself in and talked himself out of selling Leeds in that conversation probably 8 times in the space of an hour. So, there is an emotional attachment here.
Tom, I think that's a really, really good point. And it does come up quite a lot, actually. And that is the importance of selling well and legacy.
Yeah.
Particularly for these guys who are fans. You know, Marcus Evans, you know, he had a connection to do with where he was brought up in Ipswich, poured money into that club. It hasn't worked out. He's going to lose a lot of money. It's the exact same story as Mel Morris. And we get this again and again and again. And they run out of steam, they run out of energy. Perhaps family members are like, what are we doing? You know, this is nonsense.
Yeah.
So you start to look around and who's out there. So the due diligence has to go both ways. And I have a lot of sympathy for these guys because it's not as simple as just flogging your house and going, you know what, we're moving. I'm not emotionally attached to that house. If they build a horrible extension and upset the neighbours, who cares? But football clubs aren't like that. So how do you talk to guys that are selling? What kind of advice can you give them about how they get out?
I think, Matt, a lot of owners that I've spoken to, particularly in the last 12, 18 months, have been really, really considerate of what you've just said, that they just won't sell to anyone, that they really do want to find the best people from a legacy perspective. And the good owners, actually, who considered selling, wanted to stay in with a minority stake. So from an investment perspective, that's always a good sign. Because it's not a fire sale. They're happy to stay and stay around. And if they are someone who can add value, fantastic. But a lot of people will like to be in control. And, you know, the usually you're better off having, you know, one or two senior people here to just get things done and make decisions. But we've seen the German example of Dunfermline, there's four equal shareholders and they're going all right. So there's not one size fits all solution to this.
If we look to the future, are we in danger of going down a more one size fits all when it comes to club ownership? Karl-Heinz Rummenigge has done an exclusive with The Athletic. And look, there's going to be self-interest involved in this because he says we can't get to the point where only clubs owned by billionaires can compete. But of course, that favours, you know, if they make sure that that doesn't happen, that obviously favours Bayern's model of ownership.
What we love about football is the diversity and the fact that there's so many different models and there's so many different ways that you can play and the joint-killing aspect and everything else. Obviously, it makes it much tougher if owners have lots of resources and, you know, it creates inflation in the market and access for traditionally big clubs. They can't compete with the wealthier clubs. So I'm not necessarily completely free market on this. I think that we do need some level of competitive balance. But weirdly enough, we've probably, aside from City running away with this season, we've had a lot of competitive balance that's been created from people not being in stadiums and the whole circumstance. So, yeah, I don't think it will be a one-size-fits-all situation, Mark. But I think the more billionaires that we see coming into the market, the more difficult it becomes to compete if you're not in that bracket.
You mentioned City. I mean, we probably should just reference the fact that they posted their financial accounts this week. And look, you know, like everyone, COVID's had a big hit, big impact. And we've got this sort of strange situation where for a lot of the clubs, they've had to defer income because the two seasons straddled financial years. So it's very hard to do year-on-year comparisons. But I think what we can say a few things about City. It's a big loss. They've invested an awful lot in their squad. And their wage bill in particular is eye-catchingly high. And look, you know, Mark's a Man United fan. And I'm going to ask, this is really a question for Mark as well. If I was to tell you a decade ago, that City's wage bill would be 25% higher than United's, that's just a staggering thing. Just for someone who's sort of grown up as a United fan, in that city, that Man City would be paying 350 million and you'd be paying about 280.
The other thing, obviously, with United and their wage bill was that it was always very well managed as a percentage of turnover. I'd be more intrigued as, I mean, the sums are extortionate, aren't they? And I haven't looked at what the wage bill is as a percentage of turnover, either for City or for United either. But one of the big things, Tom, I remember all the way through the 90s in particular, it was always highlighted how United's wage structure was very well managed to fit in with the way the club was run, to such an extent that when they renewed Roy Keane's contract, do you remember that? They renewed Roy Keane's contract and sent a letter out to season ticket holders saying they were bumping the season ticket prices up and alluded to the fact it was because they'd given Roy Keane a new contract. I mean, I don't think he was best pleased with that at the time. But that's what I would always like. I mean, that is an eye-watering amount for City salaries. But if it fits into their business model and percentage of turnover, then it's okay, isn't it, Tom, if they can afford it?
Yeah, I think in City's instance, you know, they can absorb those losses. And even if they couldn't, they could sell a couple of players and cover them straight away. And there'd be full demand for those players. So I think I wouldn't necessarily be too worried about that from a Man City perspective. And I know you were asking about the valuation as well. I think all of the valuations have taken a little hit, and it's in the same way that all of the valuations in the likes of London have taken, like property valuations have taken a hit under the economic circumstances, but we'll bounce back. That'd be my view on the whole thing.
What would be the hardest Premier League club to buy? Newcastle fans will say Newcastle by the number of false dawns that they've had, but...
Well, I think Newcastle would be a reasonable deal to do. I'd say probably Arsenal at the moment would be because I think a lot of the other big clubs are willing to deal, but I know that they've had one or two approaches and knocked them back. But possibly, as you said, the Man United situation as well, although you can buy as many shares as you want from a listed perspective. The other thing I forgot to mention at the start when we were talking about everything, but I know I mentioned this to you, Matt, but I didn't mention our filmmaking, and I know that you know Louis Miles.
I know Louis, yeah.
But Louis and I worked on Kaiser, the greatest footballer ever to play football, which has just come out on Amazon. So it's available on Amazon Prime. So if any of your listeners haven't seen it, we'd love to hear it.
Good plug.
So the bit of advice at the end there is watch Kaiser on Amazon Prime and don't try and buy Arsenal, because that would be a bit too difficult. Tom, thank you very much for coming on. Really appreciate it. Fascinating insight. Thank you.
Guys. Thank you, Tom.
Brilliant. Cheers.
Right, that's it. Don't forget you can subscribe to The Athletic for a special price of £3.99 a month for 6 months. So that's 40% off the full price of a subscription. You'll enjoy great analysis and in-depth features from the very best football writers around, as well as ad-free versions of all of our podcasts. Just go to theathletic.com/Ornstein and Chapman to take advantage of this special 40% discount. theathletic.com/Ornstein and Chapman. We're back next week. Thanks for listening.
The Athletic.